We went through the collateral file and we found that he had a checking account and he still had money in the bank. From the original file, it was still at the bank and we popped his checking account and we got $46,000. First pop. And then he didn't take his money out of the bank. He kept on putting money in there and we went back because we didn't recover all of our money. And then we got like another like $12,000 or $13,000 about 4 or 5 months later.
As always, subscribe and click the notification bell on our YouTube channel. Be active on our Facebook group, East Coast Distressed Note Investing. And be sure to go to our website for all your note investing tools, resources, and available assets. If you have any questions, email us at tradedesk@jkpholdings.com.
Hey everyone, Dave Putz from JKP Holdings. Alongside me, as always, Mr. Nathan Turner.
Good morning, how are you?
Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. How is everyone doing? So, Nathan, I wanted to congratulate you. First off, I see you got the tickets out and the website is up for DMA.
Finally, my goodness, that was much longer than I anticipated getting that ready to go, but it's live, it's up, tickets are now available.
So the note,
everybody run to the back of the room, all that.
So for those who are not familiar with DME is, it's a note conference, right? It's for a collection of individuals like ourselves to get together and talk and learn from other investors. So if you are at all looking to learn or even experience, you should look at network, you're going to get a best collection of different people there.
Yeah. And one thing that I think is really exciting this year is you and I have been talking to a bunch of seller finance, creative finance people.
Yeah.
And we're going to get a bunch of those guys there, which is fantastic. So you've got a bunch of people that are creating notes, looking for an outlet, paired up with a whole bunch of note buyers that are looking for notes to buy. And we're going to come together at DME and meet each other and network and make contacts and get some deals done. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah. So with that said, what do you think people will be the most interested in coming down there for, besides networking? What kind of topics do you think that you'll be having if you already started to get involved?
This one's going to cover all kinds of stuff. We've got, it's a combination of panels and solo presentations. So my whole vision for this whole thing is I want people to come and be able to not just network, and that's a huge part of it. I want people to be able to network and meet people, but I want there to be enough education so that people that are just getting started feel like they've gotten something and people that are experienced feel like they've also learned something.
Gotcha.
Where it's not like, but no, we're bringing in people that you've never met before, people you've never heard before, and you're going to be able to hear what they've got to say, a different perspective.
That's huge. I know like last week we were going through some assets and we were able to acquire a couple small pool of assets. So things are starting to crack for us even. And I think it's this avenue that we're exploring in different facets. These idea of the fact that it was $30 billion of assets created in 2022 is amazing.
Yeah. There's tons out there and I'm excited to have a bunch of those people there, that people that are doing the origination. So that's great.
Yep, absolutely. So I think for most of us, this stuff is really cool and about people who are wanting to learn not just notes, but different kinds of people out there who are involved. I think people who are excited by this because of the fact that they can get into notes and that the transfer from the origination to the buyer is almost complete.
So, yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah. Really looking forward to it. It's going to be really educational and a place where you can come together and meet other people. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun. We've got some fun things going on there. The night before the conference, we've got an axe throwing tournament. What? We need to register for that separately.
Oh, cool.
But get to be part of that as well. And we'll have a DME axe throwing champion for the year. And then we'll see who takes the throne next year.
So I'm sure you guys have all heard of, you know, performing and non-performing assets, right? And a lot of times we get frustrated with them, right? Non-performing can be a bothersome situation. And we, on this last week's call, our 10-week mastermind kind of junior group, we talked about this idea of building this bid calculator, right? And you can't just build it for the fact that we are hoping or praying that the asset will perform. A lot of times they won't.
And you never know. And you have to build that in, because just because they've been making payments steady for the last 5 years doesn't mean they're going to continue to make payments steady for the next 5 years. We've been through that. We've seen it. We've experienced it. So you want to make sure that you've accounted for all possible outcomes and that you're putting it together. And so putting that bid calculator together, we've spent 2 whole classes on that. We spent a lot of time, a lot of effort putting that together. Mine is even getting updated, which is fantastic. and you know, we continue to learn and grow.
Yeah. So with that said, you know, I've done my fair share. We both grew up in this idea of a non-performing asset. And a lot of times people are saying, that's crazy, you know, because it's all different out there. Non-performing asset to a lot of people who are getting into the space the last couple of years is almost rare, because everything's performing. Everything's doing really well. And when they get in non-performing, they get themselves in a bind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They don't know how to do it.
You know, what's the route? We go through foreclosure, we go through that process, and we kind of have an asset at the end of it.
Yeah.
Right? I know you do seem to do foreclosure. We're actually in great shape. We have a few assets in foreclosure, but nothing like we used to have, right?
Yeah, we've planned for it. And that's all part of it. Understanding that this is a possible outcome. So plan for it. Know what you're in for. What would be the situation if that happened? And are you ready for that? And are you ready to take on a property if that's what the case might be?
Gotcha. So I wanted to make sure that we, you know, get someone on that can help us through that process of how can we supersize our returns in the fact that we are hoping, I'm bringing her on here, Ms. Sabrina Allen, that we can take a situation that is not in good shape or maybe small return, and how can we leverage that into a great opportunity for us?
Yeah.
So Sabrina, thank you for joining us today. Hopefully you're doing well. I know you're a little on the weather, but I'm glad to see you join us today.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
Good.
It sounds a little cliche-ish, but when you create a loan, you have to think about everything. So when you're starting at the beginning, you have to think about the end. So everybody gets all upset when you're originating a loan of all the things that you have to provide up front. And, you know, you get all pissy when you have to get all those conditions to the underwriter.
Yeah.
But there is a reason why. So when you're getting a loan, you're solid. But when you stop paying, you're not.
Right.
But all of those things that you gather at the beginning is for a reason. And so there's an underwriting file that a lot of times during the process, when loans are sold in our world, they get lost. The underwriting file gets lost. Mm-hmm. But that file is really, really golden if you get that collateral, that origination file with the collateral file. It has so much information in it.
Yeah.
When you talk about supersizing that asset. Because it really tells the story about where the borrower was at the time that they were perfect, or at least they qualified for the home.
It's that origination story that all these Marvel movies are putting out. Yes. But having that origination story, that's a big deal. And then you get to understand where they came from and why they thought they could perform on this loan way back when.
It's the glitz and the glam.
Yeah.
And it's the assets. It's the 401k. It's the IRA accounts. It's the cars they had. It's, you know, if there was a spouse, even if they weren't on the loan, but it may have been some other bank accounts, you see everything in that origination file, which is really golden for us if that file becomes non-performing and then we have to complete the foreclosure.
Yeah.
So I say, I say that to say we set up at the beginning for failure. We don't think about that when we're buying non-performing assets. No. But we really do.
Yeah.
And that is your meal ticket.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, when the return looks very slim on the back end. So begin with the end in mind. Set yourself up for success.
So, and now we got to go back a little bit, Sabrina, because if anybody doesn't know Sabrina, you've been living under a rock. But Sabrina, tell us about, you've got a ton of experience in this, especially on the origination side. So tell us, where did you start from and how did you get into what we now call notes?
So by accident, by going to work, that's how I got into this. Probably about 94, 95, I took a job at Nat City Bank in collections. Was going to work. I needed to take care of my family. I needed to help take care of my family, and just was driving to Cleveland every single day, and just the grind of it all. And I didn't like what I saw. 30, 60, 90, 120, and that was it. Went to recovery, went to charge off, went to foreclosure. And after that, I had no control. I always used to think, if I could just get a payment, I can save them. But you couldn't save everybody. And it just felt like you were always drowning. Mm-hmm. And one day I took the time to read and understand the documents that I was processing. And in the documents, the note said that we had the right to sell the document, the note, at any given time. And I was like, oh, well, if I could sell this to somebody, that would be golden. So some of us got creative. This was before all this compliance stuff. And we actually sold a lot of loans on eBay. We were selling cards on eBay. We did this huge, we sold all this stuff. We bundled it up and we sold it on eBay. We were doing a lot of leases. We sold them on eBay. And that was kind of like where we started, because I was always thinking outside the box. But then there was somebody on Wall Street who we all know, but I won't name his name, who actually had reached out and wanted to buy a note from me. And I sold that note to him for $1,000, which really created our space, because after I sold him that note for $1,000, he made it so easy. He was like, well, do you have any more of those? I started typing up, not on a spreadsheet, you guys, not on a spreadsheet, on a Word document. I started typing up loans that were charged off and sending them to him. And he was selling them to guys like Dave Van Horn, Mike Rosica, some of the guys that have been around for a long time, Kevin Cordell. In the secondary market. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was just making my bonus. just keeping it 100 with you guys. I had no idea what I was doing other than making my bonus and making my life easier as a banker. And making him promise that he wouldn't pursue a deficiency balance if he settled with these people. That was the language that we came up with. He promised me that he would never pursue a deficiency balance against anyone. So that's where kind of like, there's a language out there in our space that, oh, well, we won't pursue a deficiency balance. Well, that was a conversation that we had early on in the late 90s, that there would be no deficiency balance pursued if they bought the loan. Wow. All the way back from Nat City.
That's amazing.
So that's kind of like how I stumbled into this, this space. And in 2004, we did this over and over and over again. We started like doing $10,000 trades and went to $100,000 trades, and I was getting excited. Then we went to $250,000 trades. And I think by the time I left, we were probably doing about $850,000 to $1 million a month. And that was in 2004, late 2005 is when I actually left the bank and I went to the origination side. And then I went to go work for him also.
Okay.
But that's kind of how I got started. It was kind of by accident.
So selling non-performing loans in 2004, like right in the heyday of crazy lending and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And there were that many non-performers, you were able to sell $1 million a month.
Listen, it was so crazy. Even then, I was in a cubicle and literally I had files. Like I was drowning in a cubicle. Like they were stacked up.
Wow.
You want to know like my process on how I picked the file to send to foreclosure? I just picked one. Literally.
Wow. Winner.
I would just pick a file. There was no rhyme or reason. We were working in Lotus and DOS. There was no, I mean, like, as long as you met your goal, there was no pressure.
Wow.
Back then, things weren't in default like they were today. Like they were in 08, 09, 2010, but you still have that many loans that are defaulting in 04 with the way the market was. It's pretty astounding.
And interest rates were super, super high.
Yeah,
you know, we're complaining about interest rates today, you guys. I mean, like I was charging off stuff at 11, 12%.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
wow.
So, you know, people are like, well, you know, the Fed's is doing this on purpose. This is intentional. Well, okay. Well, 2004, we were charging off loans at 11%.
Mm-hmm.
So real quick. So those who are not keen with the word, can you define what charge-off means for those people who may not know?
A charge-off is a loan that has not performed and it has gone delinquent 120 days. And according to banking standards, if a loan has gone delinquent for 120 days, the bank has to write it off as a loss and legal action has to be called or the bank will accelerate the balance and it is due in full. And sometimes they will do a modification or allow them to start making payments again, but mm-hmm. it no longer sits in the normal realm of banking. They have to go to the special department, to the land of the misfits, recovery department.
Yeah. So most of the loans everyone bought over the years have been charged off loans, just so everyone knows. So
yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So then you got into originations, and then how did that transfer into you started buying your own?
Well, I felt like I needed to learn origination because I really didn't know origination. So I went mm-hmm. to work for, some of the CD lenders. Okay. I worked for Option One, worked for Novastar Mortgage,
okay.
and the great ones. and then went and worked for a hedge fund that was in this space that was mm-hmm. buying a lot of stuff that was from NeighborWorks of America, neighborhood housing. And when I learned the process of underwriting, it made me very, very well-rounded, where people mm-hmm. say it made me dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew the back end of mm-hmm. understanding about people when life happened. But then I also learned the process of the upfront process of all the things mm-hmm. that you needed in order to be able to get a loan and understanding credit, which made me a force to be reckoned with. Yeah. And I'm just not tech savvy. I'm not a technology guru. I just know how to.
You have it up here though.
I know how to process the information, but I don't know how to use technology. So that's my weakness is technology.
We all have weaknesses and strengths. Okay.
And so it was amazing that once I learned how to underwrite, it actually made me a better negotiator about recovering dollars. I was always really a top negotiator with recovering money for the bank. Even mm-hmm. before I learned how to sell loans, I was always a top negotiator in reference to recovering dollars. And so that's also something that I've been known for in our space in mm-hmm. negotiating workouts with people, because that's a strength that you have to have in our space when you work loans that are in default, being able to negotiate with the borrower, fact-finding information, to get that information to be able to use to your benefit, to get the dollars to actually make your loan reperforming. So,
some people may not know what underwriting is, right? I know it's long-winded, you know, origination is a big deal, and underwriting is a different thing. Can you quickly explain the difference, what they are and what they mean?
So, origination is basically when you take an application. You take an application. What consists of that? You provide income documents, assets. You tell the truth. You have to have either income, meaning income doesn't mean employment. So some form of income, and you have to be employed for at least 2 years. That's part of your application process. And then the underwriting process means that we look at and we evaluate everything. The manual part of that has been removed. We have an automated underwriting system now. There are still some people who manually underwrite, but a lot of it is just basically we put it into a system and it basically gives us what our conditions are to get your loan approved. But we still will verify the information. So there is still a human approach, a human touch to that.
But the math equation, pretty much.
Yes. And in the underwriting process, what it does is it also allows you to verify the income, verify your tax returns. It just wants to verify that you're being truthful and you're credit worthy. So most of us right now are doing underwriting at 580 to 620 credit scores. Even with the, I heard you guys talk about seller financing, which I do a lot of. Those are the scores that we like to see, you know, 580 to 620 credit scores when we're doing some seller financing or loaning out our IRA money. And those are the same scores that a lot of the banks want to use as well.
Great. So it's really interesting you get to that point and you now you're underwriting and originating paper, getting the collateral file together for these people. And then when you create these notes, you know, there's no promise or guarantee that the borrower, for no fault of their own, go through slumps and issues and problems, right? Mm-hmm. It could be a health situation, could be a job situation, could be a marriage situation, could be a kid situation. We have numerous reasons throughout the years why people don't perform. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's no fault of their own, right? We've heard the stories, the kid gets sick, I ain't paying my mortgage payment, I'm gonna make my kid better. And we all get that. I mean, it makes sense to all of us parents. So, but when we have people out there that do things like this, who underwrite everything, do everything right, and then for whatever reason, don't make the payment, right? What is the process from that point, from a bank situation, to retrieve some of their money that is in the, to retrieve their money that's in the deal, for those who may not understand what that process is? So if a loan goes 120 days, the bank has to take legal action. What does that look like in the bank situation?
Okay, so I'm gonna hit you with something in reference to some loans are backed by the government. So some loans have PMI on it.
Yep.
And if a loan is backed by the government, PMI will help cushion that blow after the foreclosure is completed. Foreclosure has to be completed. A lot of stuff that we see in our world has no PMI on. Let's be clear. There are some loans that still have some PMI on it, because I know some loans that we had purchased that were housed at BSI did have some PMI on them. And we were able to file those claims. But you have to complete the foreclosure before you can do anything. Gotcha. To see where your loss is going to be. Okay. You either have to go through a judicial process or a non-judicial process. That means that you either have to go through the court and a judge makes a decision, or you have somebody like Matt Kelly and you go through trustee court and it's sold at the court on a court step. And that's how the asset is sold. And they're taking the action of the note and the asset. I'll say the asset is recovered. When I say the asset is recovered, we get the, I'm sorry, you got somebody's at my door.
Oh, good. Real-time video.
you get the asset back, or it's sold to a third party.
Sure.
If it's sold to a third party, doesn't mean that you're going to recover your full entire balance. And what I mean by that is that, so let's just use round numbers, $100,000. $100,000 of property sold, but you're owed $200,000. Mm-hmm. And the property goes and there's a deficiency balance. Because of the asset, it's gone, and you can't, you didn't recover all your money at the sale.
Right.
So define what deficiency balance means to an investor.
You're negative. You were owed 200, but you only recovered 100. Mm-hmm. And but there are some states that there's deficiency is barred. So the ACA has a template that will tell you if you can pursue a deficiency balance or not. So the ACA is the Association of Credit and Collections Professionals. It's something that you guys can join. Cool. And it's a great place for credit and collection people. The ACA is also a place where you can actually also know what you can, what you need to do if you want to be licensed to be a servicer. But it's a great place to learn compliance rules and regulations about our world.
Sure.
They have every state, every rule, every regulation on deficiency balances that you can pursue or you can't pursue. So we had a template and we use Salesforce at the hedge fund that I used, that I worked for. And when we finished the foreclosure, after we were done, we would either mark it deficiency barred or deficiency not barred. And we would mark it. And if we had a deficiency balance, we would tell the attorney, pursue deficiency balance if we were able to. We would just mark it and we would know that we were able to pursue that balance.
Gotcha. And how many states do you think that it's barred in? I don't have the states. So I'm curious, what do you think your guesstimate is? How many states don't allow you to go after that?
Probably about 30%.
Wow.
Okay.
That much.
Okay. I think about 30%. So you have to think about the friendly states.
Nice word for it.
I'm just saying you have to think about the friendly states.
Yeah.
And
not California.
Well, I mean, just think about that. Look what you got to do to get somebody out of a house in California.
This is true.
You might be bankrupt by the time you get somebody out of
this. That's how you do it.
So, after you've completed everything, you've liquidated the asset, and there's still money owed to you, you're in the deficit. Mm-hmm. Can you collect that money?
Sure.
According to your note, yes. Mm-hmm. The mortgage is gone. The asset is gone. So this is why you have two different instruments. You have a note and you have a mortgage. Now the house is gone. The collateral is gone. But this is why you now have the mortgage, and that's the instrument. That's the promissory note that now you can now enforce.
Yeah. So the mortgage is the lien on the property that secures the property to the IOU, right? So right. When you go after a mortgage, you're going up to a lien position situation, and that lien's now gone. But that person still owes you an IOU based on the terms inside the promissory note.
Right.
If you have a house that you sell at the auction for $100,000 because it's upside down or whatever reason, but you're owed $200,000 according to legal balance, you have the legal right in those states to go after the $100,000 personally because that person still owes you that money.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So that was probably just as clear as mud. But so I had one in Ohio. I'll give you a factual statement. I mean, a factual story. So we had one in Ohio that we actually had purchased a note in Ohio, and it was a Nat City note, and it went to foreclosure sale, and it was a condo that foreclosed, the association foreclosed, and we thought we had got wiped because the condo had foreclosed, and so. There were surplus funds after the condo association had foreclosed, and we said, "Well, do we want to actually fight this? What do we want to do?" So we actually filed for the surplus funds from the HOA foreclosing. We took those funds and we made a decision to actually pursue the note, and we went through the collateral file. And we found that he had a checking account and he still had money in the bank from the original file. It was still at the bank and we popped his checking account and we got $46,000.
Ooh.
First pop. And then he didn't take his money out of the bank. He kept on putting money in there. And we went back because we didn't recover all of our money. And then we got like another like $12,000 or $13,000 about 4 or 5 months later.
Wow.
And this took like about a year and a half. It wasn't like an overnight process, but it was a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah.
What is the process to start that deficiency judgment against someone? Is it during the foreclosure period? Is it after?
It's after. So the foreclosure has to be completely done. And the foreclosure has to be closed. And then you have to tell the attorney that you want a deficiency judgment. They get the deficiency judgment. And then you can do a wage attachment. You can do a bank attachment. And then once you get that and you actually know where there's assets, then you actually have the attorney's office take care of that paperwork and send it in, and you get the attachment. You get it granted and you get the money.
And they how often does that happen these days? Like I only started seeing equity in about 2018. And now that seems like all I ever see is loans that have equity, excuse me, in the property. So are you still seeing that today where there's a surplus there where you can go after that?
I haven't seen a lot of surplus, a little bit, but not much. I've just recently, as you, you have recently mm-hmm. just started seeing surplus again. But sometimes there's overage.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it's not, if you're white, you still have the right to enforce the note and ask for the deficiency if you're allowed to ask for the deficiency.
And then I assume that it's state by state as far as the statute of limitations up mm-hmm. to so many years later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. There is a I'll call him an old soul in California. I love him to death because a lot of the old guys taught me so much about the way they did business. So I gravitated to a lot of the older guys in business. Because I learned so much. Yeah. And he actually would renew judgments in California and got very, very wealthy doing it and been doing it since like the 80s. And I was like, wow, that's neat. And he was like, well, you know, Sabrina, I'm going to renew this judgment. And I'm like, well, how? He was like, well, because you can renew it so many years. And
I guess like a statute of limitations, you have to renew that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was renewing judgments in certain states that he was permitted to do so. And he stayed on top of it. So he actually had like a calendar, like every time it was time for a judgment to renew in his office, especially like on people who had properties over like $400,000, mm-hmm. he would renew those judgments because his mindset is like people who lived in those type of properties, they were prideful people and they would always have a certain type of lifestyle. And eventually they would come back. They would come back up and he would basically get something from them down the line. And most times he did. Or they would want to buy something or they would want to sell something and they'd have to satisfy that judgment before they could.
Yeah. Just quick things. Cindy Coleman before said hello. She wanted to make sure I got it out across to you. Cindy's a common follower of us. She wanted to make sure she said hello. We did have a question from John. You mentioned about going after people with money in an account.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that they have money in an account? What's that process of finding out where their accounts are, how to levy them, and you know, even things like tax returns?
Okay, so you guys, so Microbelt. Some of you guys know about Microbelt, right?
Yep.
Some of you guys belong to Microbelt. There is a feature with Microbelt that does an asset search for you. Look at that on the drop down on the side. You can actually do an asset search through Microbelt and it will come back and it will give you hits for assets. That's one way you can do it. Two, go back to that origination file that you had when you buy your note.
Mm-hmm.
So we get cheap, we get lazy in the note space and we don't want to pay for all those copies for Richmond Monroe or Casey Wilson to make all those copies, or we don't want to pay the storage fee for that origination file. That information, you guys, is golden. I have had the same checking account for over 30 years. Now, I'm not, you can't get a deficiency judgment against me, but I've had that same checking account for over 30 years. So I put a voided check in my file when I bought my house. Mm-hmm. So when you're going through those files, that checking account information is there. Even if a bank merges, your checking account number doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Even if when you put your assets on the 1003 or the IRLA now that we call it, that information is on your loan application. All you got to do is call and see if the bank account is open.
Mm-hmm. So if someone doesn't have a connection to Merck, can they go find assets through a service out there that can?
Well, you know, we have a few people that say they can find assets that show up at our note events and things like that, but I don't know how credible they are. They say that they can find assets, you know, you can hire private investigators, you can hire companies to do that. Yeah, you can. But I've been successful even on finding assets through the microbelt option.
But if someone doesn't have access to microbelt, is there places that can like wholesale microbelt, like they can do the search for them?
No, you know you can't do that. That's not permissible.
I'm just asking, right? Because I'm presuming most people are gonna say, well,
Nathan, I'm not. Nathan, now you know he's breaking, you know David is breaking the rules, even asking that question.
Right? That's the problem right now, right? Because a lot of people here may be a one or two investor. They say, oh, I'm not gonna be part of microbelt. How can I go find his assets if I'm not, you know, doing this full time and not buying a bunch of assets? And I'm maybe do it one time, right?
Okay.
How can they go about doing it?
So the other thing is like a lot of our attorneys that we use for foreclosure, they use LexisNexis. LexisNexis is very expensive, but LexisNexis also has a tool to search for assets. So that's another way that you can do that. Not only are you looking for bank account information, but you can also attach to other property, you guys. Mm. So you deficiency judgment, you get a judgment, you attach to other property. Think about it. Let's think outside the box.
Yeah, you can attach to a whole county and just everything that person owns. Mm-hmm.
So I've got a situation where it's not a deficiency judgment, it's just a judgment. So I had a contractor that was going to do some work on a property. I paid him in advance, which I don't normally do, but I did because I decided to trust him for some reason. And then he took my money and didn't do any of the work. And I never do this, but I did this time because I was just insulted. So I went ahead and hired an attorney to get in a judgment. Judgment was granted, but now we can't find this guy. So it's in Tennessee and I've got time. Tennessee's got a nice long statute of limitations there. What's my best way of collecting on that?
Where at in Tennessee?
It's in Kingsport.
And you know they call me the godmother of notes for a week. And it's because it's the Guido in me now. Has he just fallen off the face of the earth?
Yeah, I mean, we've tried Facebook and like everything. We've tried all kinds of different things to track this guy down, and he's just kind of disappeared. It's keeping a low profile at the very least.
Have you tried like Lowe's, Home Depot? Have you called the Lowe's, Home Depot?
Nope. I'm going to make a note.
So call the Pro Desk.
Okay.
Become friends with the Pro Desk and see if he is taking other business through the Pro Desk. Because if he's a contractor, he is. And then the sad thing is a lot of the contractors, you know, don't have a lot.
Right.
Do you have his first and last name?
I've got his first and last name, but not... as far as I know, he doesn't actually have a business. He's just a guy. So I don't even know if he's licensed, which again, is all it's on me. I hired a guy that's just a guy, and I totally get it. And a big mistake.
We learn. We live and we learn. We have hearts. It's okay. We have hearts.
I mean, Cindy mentioned, have you checked jail or prison? But I'm presuming if he's there, the judgment won't do too much good for you.
It's not going to do me a whole lot of good. I hear you don't make a lot of money in jail.
Try, Cindy, though.
but really try the Home Depot, Menards, and Lowe's. And this is what I will tell you about contractors, because mm-hmm. I do a lot of fix and flips. They are remorseful. And sometimes they will come back and they will redeem themselves.
Okay.
Believe it or not, they are remorseful, especially if you call out the Lowe's and Home Depot and Bears.
Right.
Well, Lowe's and Home Depot talk to you? I mean, will they actually?
Just so you got to be friends with the people at the pro desk.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. You know, just call and just talk nice to them. They just want somebody to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah. I can talk. That's all right. That's good. Good tip. Good tip. I will do that.
When we look at these things, it sounds to me as you can pick a situation that may not be great and you may just barely get out. Mm-hmm. And a year later, your returns can just be amazing because you can go after this money that the borrower still owes you through a mm-hmm. legal process, wage garment. And we talked on the phone about this and I never even thought about it. But taxes, your tax return for next year is now yours.
So that's the other thing that I used to watch when we would look to offset people's accounts. So I, again, because the underwriter in me, so they had kids and their kids were still minors and I thought they still banked at the same bank. I would then wait around tax time, knowing when they probably file their tax returns. Because people are just like, they're creatures of habit.
Right.
I would get that bank attachment around the time of tax return, and I would know that I'm gonna get their tax return with that bank attachment because they had kids. Now, shame on me that I'm gonna take their tax return, but that's when I would try to get that bank attachment.
It's no, you know, and I had a conversation once with a friend of mine where I was kind of feeling bad that I was forcing this contract. You know, somebody had created this note at some point in time and now they're not doing it. And here I come. And I kind of felt like I was the big bad guy saying, you owe me money or else. And in this conversation with my friend, he said, no, you're holding them accountable to something they've already agreed to. And he's totally right. And that made me feel a lot better about it. And anybody who knows me knows I am the least vengeful person you've ever met. But I believe in fair and I believe in, you know, doing what you say you're going to do. And so me holding them accountable to what they've already signed up for, I'm totally okay with that.
You know, and you could choose not to do this, right? That's a big thing. Say you have an older couple and the husband passes away and then the wife loses the house.
Yeah.
You technically go after her? You can. But you don't need to, right?
Right.
You can have the option to. Randolph mentioned tracking through a license plate. I don't know how we can do that, but that's a great idea. We can try finding anyone that way. But I think that for me, that you can, this opportunity to take people who may just be screwing you at times, or just didn't play ball, play games, maybe file, you know, BK twice, where you can just
So if, you know, if they file BK, you can't pursue the deficiency. Just right. So yes, no. So if they've been discharged in the bankruptcy, you can't pursue the deficiency. It's
gone. I'm saying with people who may file the last minute and then never do the plan and then do it again.
Yeah, the notorious filers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Those people you can definitely file against once you can get the foreclosure and the BK barred, frozen for a minute. Go after those people that just play games. This is something we have the opportunity to do. And I don't know many people who have done it. And I think it's the fact that lack of knowledge, lack of experience, but because it's not commonplace to be happening, but it is possible to do in certain states, of course.
And then the other thing that I want to point out to you guys is about accounting is very important when you are going through deficiency, you know, if you want to pursue a deficiency balance, if a judge is going to, you know, if a judge is going to challenge you on your balance when you're trying to pursue a deficiency. So we talk about, you know, corporate advances of taxes or, you know, recoverable fees and expenses. This is why it's important to use a servicer. Us, you know, tracking our own expenses and doing all of these things where we think we're saving money, but then we want to recover on the back end on a deficiency balance. Use a servicer, even if it's a, you know, a low budget servicer for the accounting purposes of being able to recover our money. Make sure that your accounting is in order and it's traceable and it's trackable. So I want to point that out to everyone also. And the other thing that I want to also say is that it's important that you've worked your file. And what I mean by that is that there is documentation that you made an attempt to work out. There was an attempt to make reaches. There was attempts to at least give a chance, because sometimes you're going to get a pushback from a judge or from someone that if you don't work out something, you didn't work out something with the borrower, that judge is not going to look friendly on us. They're going to look like we're going to be the big bad villains. So at least if we did what we were supposed to do as the creditor, as the lender, then if we do do the judgment, if we do do the deficiency, if we do do the offset, we did what we were supposed to do and we follow and we were compliant on the books.
Yeah.
So I think that that's
for the judges, that's a much better approach. And they will be more gracious with our requests and understand our requests better than if we're just fly by the night doing a half-assed kind of situation. And we learn ourselves that the more we put into this and the more good faith we put into it, and you tried everything, the judges respect that request at that point.
And also policies and procedures. So you know how you heard me say that every file that when the foreclosure was completed, we documented if the deficiency was barred or not, that we documented it in the system. It was an automatic deficiency barred, deficiency not barred, deficiency pursued, deficiency not pursued. We documented that. So if anybody ever audited us where a borrower would say that they're targeting me, they're picking on me. So this was just part of the process where you didn't get this emotionally out of control because you've used your IRA money and you're hell bent. And I'm going to go get this person because they didn't pay me back. And I'm going to do everything in my power because they pissed me off on the phone. We in our world, in our space, tend to be a little bit more emotional than just the regular banker, collector, servicer, collector. So I kind of want to bring that into you guys too, to just kind of think about that. We are human. It sometimes it's not easy. It is our money. We've worked for it. We are investors. We're risk takers. Some of our risk tolerance are always the same. Some of our risk tolerance are high, some of them are low. And we have to think about all of those things, even when we're thinking about a deficiency judgment.
Yeah.
We have to be machine-like too, right? We have to be just that boom, 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 boom. Hey, listen, anything that we have, it's a 20% loss, we do this, X, Y, Z, and come from about a business versus it's an investment. That's a good point, because a lot of people think about this as a business, but they act like it's an investment, which is, it is an investment, but you can't treat it in the eyes of the court as, hey, it's my money, I want it back in certain situations. You know, we've had throughout the years where we've had opportunity to do deficiency judgments, and I've often not, you know, most time they have no money really to a point, right? Can I go after the, you know, we had one, it was $100,000 loss situation, but it was an old lady, that husband was just, it was wheelchaired. And they were to get $600 back in tax, nothing coming through. And for me, it wasn't worth the effort. Is there a cost in per se for these deficiency judgments for someone to do? What's the typical cost to get this thing filed, approved, and start levering accounts?
So again, attorney's time, but generally like court costs, could be between $150 and $300. And then really important, and this is a good question, you need to negotiate what it's going to cost you with your attorney up front so they don't milk you. Because what eats us up in our space is attorney fees, because they just milk us, milk us, milk us. So understanding what it's going to cost us up front with the attorney, what is it going to cost us for you to file a deficiency judgment against for us? Is it included in our foreclosure cost? Every time you you send an offset to a bank, what is that fee? What does that look like? Look at their fee structure. If there's additional administration costs, and also, is it a cheaper rate if your paralegal does it versus you doing it?
This is true.
Yeah. Oh, good. Absolutely. Very interesting stuff. I had same thing. I've had opportunities to get the deficiency judgment. I had my attorney ask me if I want to go for it. And I've always just automatically just, no, it's fine. It's good. Leave it alone.
We're going to start wrapping up soon. I want to make sure people out there who do have questions, feel free to chime in here before we disconnect and let Sabrina go. Sabrina has been in the space for God knows how long, right? Doing all different avenues in the note space, from accidentally selling assets and accidentally stumbling across these opportunities to being in the servicing space, being in the origination space. She's done everything. So it's really cool to have her on because of her knowledge, experience. So Hal asked a question: how do courts look at deficiency judgments? Do judges favor homeowners in those cases? And I think, as you just explained, it's typically how the lender treats that borrower. Would that be accurate?
I would say it depends on the judge. I will say it depends on the judge, because you have judges that are super, super consumer friendly. And then you have other judges that are just, they're just by the book. It is what it is. And it's horrible to say that, I can remember having an argument with somebody. I said, federal trumps state all the time. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you should hope that that stuff just stays in state court and it never goes federal. Because you get better treatment in state court than you do federal court. And so it's kind of the same thing. You can go in Judge Judy's courtroom and it's hell on wheels. You can go in Judge Jones's courtroom and it's just like, oh, I'm so glad I got Judge Jones. Yeah. So you don't know. You really don't know. Sitting as I've been used as an expert witness. I've been, I've had to go in mediation hearings, and you just really never know how that stuff is going to turn out.
Sure. Interesting. It's interesting to have that kind of concept, because you're right. Sometimes you can do everything you can in your power, but still the judge's opinion on what they think is in favor of or not in favor of. And it's sometimes a live and learn, right? You may say, oh boy, they want us to do this next time. And attorneys are always learning about the judges, right? You ask an attorney about that local judge, you're going to learn a lot. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn, oh yeah, that judge likes this, or that judge likes that, or hey, listen, we got to do this with this judge. They get to learn their personality.
Mm-hmm. True story. I was in Alabama in a mediation case, and we were going to use an attorney that wasn't familiar with the judge. This judge was a trip. And probably the 11th hour, I changed to a local judge. A local attorney was probably the best thing I ever could have done. I vacation with this lawyer now. Her and I are really good friends. And she said, well, what made you change your mind? I said, it sure wasn't your hourly fee. I said, I realized you were a local. I was doing some research and I saw that both of the judge and the attorney was at an event together, like a golf outing, just kind of doing some research. And I said, hey, they're at the same place. I said, I think I'm going to change lawyers. And that was what saved me. Wow. So you just never know. But, it's one of those things that if you don't understand the politics in that city or in that courtroom, sometimes you're just going to lose.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So this like we were saying before, this seems like it works better in an upside down market where mm-hmm. more people owe more than what the house is worth. Do you see that coming around again? What's your crystal ball? Do you see house values dropping enough that we're going to see those underwater values again?
I've been watching the market this week, and I've been seeing prices drop more drastically this week than I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Prices dropping $10,000-$15,000. And, you know, like in my market where like I pay cash for low end price properties, I mean, like I'm chomping at the bits. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean for other people? I think it's going to be a ripple effect. You know, like for a buy and hold, mm-hmm. Seller finance people, I think it's going to be really a good thing for some of us. But for those people who are doing bank loans, we're going to probably see some mods coming down the pipeline. And my crystal ball just says that we're going to brace ourselves. CFPB is not going to let what happened in 2008 happen, but no. We're going to see some things really shift and change.
Very interesting.
Interesting. Well, with that, Sabrina, I want to thank you for coming on with us on this Friday morning, afternoon kind of time frame. Share your knowledge, your experience with us and those watching us and listening to us. A lot of people are saying they want to go back to the beginning because they missed earlier. Please do so. You can check out on YouTube, Facebook, video will be here, LinkedIn, all that stuff. And, you know, just having you on, having your knowledge in it, I encourage you guys to reach out to Sabrina and ask if you have questions, whatever. If you are in a space where you're looking to learn, she's another valuable resource to kind of leverage your knowledge off of. But for you to come on and spend an hour with us with your busy time, I appreciate it. Because deficiency judgment is an area that most people don't actually do or know about, or mm-hmm. not even taught, really. You know, think about it now. In the many conferences we've been to, it's not a topic of your discussion often. And I think it's because most of the time people don't know about it, don't use it. And the markets change a lot, right? There's not as many underwater assets as there was back in our day in 2010, 9 timeframe. So I think that your experience knowledge is awesome with that 9. So if you do have additional questions, I posted in the chat the webinar link to our forum so we can, if you have questions, I can just forward it right over to Sabrina. But I know on Facebook, you know, Sabrina Hawkins, you can reach out to her that way or shoot us a message and we'll send her the contact information. So, well, Sabrina, again, I thank you for joining us on this Friday afternoon for us. And hopefully, you know, in the future, we can reconnect with you. Sabrina, are you currently with somebody right now as business-wise? Are you working for someone right now?
So I actually work for Premier Bank as a loan originator. And I also I'm still with Main Street Asset Solutions. Mm-hmm. Business is really slow, but I'm still with them, helping them clean up some things. And I do some mentoring and coaching on the side and do my fix and flip. So I'm pretty busy. And I do plan on seeing you guys in Tennessee this summer in June. So I was excited to get your ticket released. So I will see you guys in Tennessee. And you guys should join. Always good to see you guys. And thanks for having me. And if I could be of service to you guys, you know, don't hesitate to reach out. Let me know. I'll do anything in my power to help you.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Sabrina.
Thank you so much.
All right.